And then the hearing is going to begin. So good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Hawaii Supreme Court Courts in the Community program. My name is Donna Payesco. I'm president of the West Hawaii Bar Association. This morning's oral argument is part of Courts in the Community, which is the Hawaii Supreme Court's educational outreach program, which gives high school students the opportunity to learn about and experience how the justice system in our state works. I don't have a lot of acknowledgments, but just a few. First of all, we would like to thank Kealakehe High School, the administration, and for all of their efforts that went on to bring this program here. Thank you so much. We would like to thank the Hawaii State Bar Foundation for its support in providing lunches and transportation for all of you students. Thank you. We would like to thank the West Hawaii Bar Association for providing lunch for the attorneys and all of the beverages for the events. I would also like to acknowledge Paradise Beverages and Long's Drugs, who both were gracious enough to donate some of the beverages that we're providing today. So let's acknowledge our business partners. The Hawaii State Bar Association and the West Hawaii Bar Association for their help in organizing this event, for organizing the volunteer attorneys. Thanks, HSBA, WHBA. And lastly, I'd like to thank all of the volunteer attorneys. So if you were a volunteer attorney in a classroom, could you just stand up? Thanks, volunteer attorneys, for giving of your time and your talents, for helping these students understand this case. We really appreciate it. And lastly, I want to thank the students. I want to thank all of you for your enthusiasm and the way you've received us and appreciated understanding and learning about this case. So thank you. Thank you for being here. So with that, the hearing will begin.
attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-16-647, State v. Kaneayakala. Arguing for petitioner, Mr. Michael J. Park. Arguing for respondent, Ms. Lauren J. Thomas, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today at Kealakehe High School as part of our Courts in the Community program. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? All right, Mr. Park, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, and so we'll give you a green light with 10 minutes to go in your argument. Ms. Thomas, you've asked for a 10-minute warning, so there'll be a green light for you as well. Mr. Park, please proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices, court staff, esteemed guests, ladies and gentlemen, and students. I am Michael Park, representing Bronson Kaneakala, petitioner appellate. Eyewitness testimony is among the most powerful of all evidence that can be used in a court of law. When an eyewitness points a finger at a defendant and says, "He did it. I saw him." You might think the case is a done deal, but there are procedures that the police must follow to determine if the eyewitness is a reliable source. It is the constitutional right of an accused that these procedures are followed or carried out to prevent misidentification. We have no clear method for establishing the frequency of misidentification based on faulty eyewitness testimony, but due process of law can level the playing field. In State v. DeCenzo, this court held field show-ups are inherently and unduly suggestive. The Intermediate Court of Appeals for this state has held that a field identification period procedure in which a suspect was handcuffed, flanked with uniformed police officers, and spotted with headlights from police vehicle, at which point the victim was driven and identified, the suspect was considered impermissibly suggestive in Ray Dole.
Mr. Park, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is there any question in this case about whether or not this identification was a result of a suggestive show-up?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wasn't that stipulated too?
That is correct. The law is well settled, as well as the prosecution have stipulated or agreed that the procedural method that the police used in this case was impermissibly suggestive.
Then is your focus on reliability?
It is, Your Honor. But part of the methodology and procedure utilized would also be factors and circumstances to assess the witness's reliability in this case and to see if we can actually rely on her.
Okay, so you're not arguing for an absolute rule that if there's a suggestive show up that that evidence is excluded, correct?
No.
Okay, and do you think the circuit court here applied the correct test in then analyzing whether this evidence could come in? Are you arguing for a different test, or do you think she applied the correct test but simply got it wrong?
They got it wrong.
So you're not arguing for a different test. Do you think that those five factors constituting the totality of circumstances is sufficient based on the newer information we have now as to issues regarding eyewitness identification?
Yes, there are other factors beyond the five factors that currently exist, which I believe are addressed and was addressed in this case during the trial.
What about before the trial? The judge has to make a determination whether the identification is even reliable enough to go to the jury. Right now we have five factors, and how do those factors measure the level of suggestiveness?
Well, as the prior courts and decisions have noted, there are five salient factors. There are further factors that I believe was presented to the jury and that are required. And yes, I would...
Mr. Park, I'm sorry to interrupt you also, but I think what Justice Pollack is getting at was pretrial.
It's correct.
Pretrial.
I believe that the trial court judge pretrial should utilize all the factors that are listed.
And did you think the trial judge did that in this case? Used all salient factors in determining that the pretrial identification should be admitted?
No. And also they made the erroneous, I guess, findings.
What was wrong about the findings?
Well, the... one moment.
Did Ms. Larraway testify that she was sure...
Yes.
That this was the...
It appeared at trial...
That was the finding.
It appeared at trial that she testified
I'm sorry,
she was sure.
But we're talking about the findings of fact, conclusions of law on the motion to suppress, not what she testified to at trial.
Yes.
On the motion to suppress, did she testify that she was sure that the defendant was the person she saw earlier?
Yes.
That was... Really? Where in the transcript did she say she was sure? I only saw pretty sure.
Correct.
Isn't there a difference between pretty sure and sure?
Definitely. And that's the whole point. Defense's petitioner's argument is saying that the way in which the police handled this investigation was such that it moved from a guess by the witness to feeling confidently assured that she had identified the proper person at trial.
Well, did she testify that she was guessing?
No, but Your Honor, one moment.
And the reason we're asking you these questions, Mr. Park, is because you have a high burden to show that the court clearly erred. In other words, the trial court was there, got to observe the witnesses, hear their testimony live, and so, as you know, under a standard of clear error, that's a pretty high burden for you to carry. So what is it in the record that you can point to that suggests the trial court engaged in an error that really is quite clear?
Okay, I'd like to just go on with my argument, and I believe I would be able to answer that within the argument.
Very well.
Okay.
If you'll come back to it, I'd appreciate it.
Yes. And I apologize. In this case, Bronson Kaneakala had been accused and convicted of burglary chiefly on the testimony of a one eyewitness person who identified him at trial. And at the time of the incident, the eyewitness, Mari Larraway, had selected Kaneakala from a field show-up. This identification procedure, a field show-up, is declared impermissibly suggestive, as indicated by the law and stipulated by the government. The show-up consisted of, or while being escorted by the police at the scene, the witness was asked to identify a person they captured at the apartment complex where the burglary occurred a few hours earlier. Before the witness identified petitioner, a police officer told her they had captured the guy. At this point, I would argue that the witness assumed that the police captured the same male she had seen earlier. And in fact, she did indicate that once the police had indicated to her that they had captured a guy and wanted to identify this, wanted her to make identification of this individual, she said herself that she thought that they had captured the guy that she had seen earlier. And when the field show-up was conducted, Kaneakala was handcuffed, the police was standing around him. He was the only individual who was not a police officer. The police asked the witness to look at only one male, and when she was asked to look at the male, she didn't want to look at him directly because she had this conception and expectation that this was the individual who was the suspect.
Do those factors that this court has been applying, do they take in those circumstances that you've just mentioned? In other words, whether or not a person has handcuffs on, whether the person is standing next to the police officer, whether the police says we captured somebody, are any of those part of our five-factor test? And did the judge
consider
them?
Right. A short answer, no. There are circumstances surrounding the methodology that the police use that unduly suggest and lead an individual who may be guessing about identification towards a particular view.
Let me ask this a different way. Let's suppose that the facts were a little bit different. Let's suppose the police officer went up to the witness and said, we have the person, and the person's going to be standing next to the police officer with handcuffs on, and we have that person there, and all you need to do is to point to that person. Would the result have been any different under the factors that has been part of our precedent?
I apologize. I missed a part of that.
In other words, level of suggestiveness, do any of these circumstances that you've been pointing at, are they measured within our... Do any of these five factors, again, do they consider even a statement to an eyewitness, we have the person, just point them out?
No, because the five factors are factors with respect to the witness and not the conduct of the police. And the conduct of the police in field show-ups, in certain investigation, would lead to an unduly suggestive situation.
Were there differences between the description that the witness provided in the 911 call as compared to the description that she provided after the field show up?
Yes, there were substantial differences, and they were actually inconsistencies. For instance, at the onset, the witness called 911 and spoke to the operator, and she described the individual, the suspect, as a skinny black male wearing a t-shirt or tank top, wearing shorts. And the shirt was blue, the shorts was blue, and that he was also wearing a hat. The witness was asked on at least three other occasions to somewhat identify a suspect. These identifications should have been done earlier before the field show up. And the police nevertheless showed the suspect to Ms. Larway, the witness, and she made subsequent identifications in her suspect identification form that should have been completed before she was shown the suspect.
Mr. Park, could I follow up on Justice McKenna's question about the nature of the identification in the 911 tape versus the subsequent identifications. Because in the 911 tape, before the show-up, the witness gives a certain description of the suspect that, as you said, includes the fact he was a skinny black guy, and also that there was a tank top or a t-shirt that was light blue. And I wanted to ask you, with respect to that description and the evidence in the case, if we accept your proposition that this was impermissibly suggestive and therefore come to the conclusion that the motion to suppress should have been granted, why isn't it the case that it's harmless error because the identification in 911 was provided and is admissible, and then you have him being discovered actually wearing a watch and being discovered in the presence of the clothing of the victim?
Because the witness, the eyewitness that the government, the only witness that the government has of the particular burglar suspect, her description changes.
Well, if we just exclude all the description except the 911 tape, that's what I'm proposing to you, that we agree that the evidence should have been excluded because it was impermissibly suggestive, and so that whole identification is excluded, isn't there still evidence that would say it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, because her description is, her subsequent descriptions from the 911 to the suspect identification form is so varied, so different.
What,
we cannot rely.
I think what Justice Wilson is saying is, let's disregard her subsequent descriptions. Assuming all we have is the 911 call where she describes a skinny black guy with a hat, wearing a light blue or white t-shirt or tank top, going through the window of this building, you know, with the jalousies removed and the screen rolled up, and she sees this body going through the window, and then he is subsequently, a person is found in the laundry room of the same building with a blue shirt and black shorts near him, wearing a watch that was taken from the apartment with tools, burglary tools, lying right next to him. Why wouldn't the subsequent identifications, if we excluded it, why wouldn't the conviction, the admission of any potentially inadmissible testimony be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt as to this conviction?
And I might add that a hat was involved as well, right?
Correct.
The 911 tape, the witness identifies a hat being on the suspect, and then when the suspect is discovered in the laundry room, they also discover a hat.
Correct. Well, looking at some of the other factors in determining whether this person should be reliable would probably address why that would not be sufficient and it could possibly not be harmless error. But we don't have that in this case. We have a lot of conflicting subsequent suspect identification. For instance, in her suspect identification form, she says that the individual who was the burglar was Caucasian. She had an opportunity to mark off on that form that he was black. She didn't do that.
As a matter of fact, doesn't that belie your argument that seeing him then made her identify him later? Because also in that form, she also says he has long pants on, and when she saw him, he was wearing black shorts. Mm-hmm. So, but I echo my colleagues.
Right.
Put aside all the possible errors regarding identification. They find your client naked in a laundry room with the fruits of, well, items taken from the burglary, items of clothing that match what the witness said. How is that not any any error they made, the trial court may have made, why is that error not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt when you take into consideration the other evidence?
Right, and I think you do, I think that some of the other factors like the witness's opportunity to view the suspect, the accuracy of the prior descriptions, the level of certainty that she demonstrated, and the length of time between the crime and the confrontation would lead, when we discuss those factors, would lead to this not being harmless.
How would that go to harm? I'm so sorry. How would that go to harmlessness? I mean, again, if we accept everything that you're arguing, that the trial court should have suppressed the identification, isn't there enough other evidence in the record that that error was simply harmless?
No,
didn't affect the proceedings.
No, because when you look at the police method in having this individual go up to a field trial, and that how it was so prejudicial in that methodology, that a person who really did not have a good opportunity to see, had only 3 to 5 seconds at best to glance at this individual, and made such differing comparisons.
So is it your argument that that testimony coming in effect, prejudiced the jury in a way that we can't say the error was harmless? Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly. As well as when you look at the methodology that the police used, it was so, it was designed so that the witness would be able to or would identify a person that she wasn't quite sure.
I'm sorry, Justice McKenna.
Do you think, in terms of the test that we have adopted so far, first we decide whether or not it's suggestive. In this case, there's a stipulation that it was suggestive. Even if it is suggestive, our case law says then you look at the totality and you analyze the five factors to decide whether or not the identification was in any event reliable, right? It appears that so far we have said that it is the defendant's burden to prove that the identification was unreliable. Whose burden do you think it should be? Should it be the defendant's burden to show that the identification was unreliable, or should it be the state's burden to show that the identification was nevertheless reliable?
On that point, and I think the court should consider that possibly, or create a rule that the police can only use these types of field show-ups, impermissibly show-ups, if there are maybe exigent circumstances. For instance, if there is no time, there's a lack of time for a witness to make, for the police to do a more neutral lineup. So possibly there should
be
a rule.
Are you asking us to adopt the Wisconsin rule that says that field show-ups are not even permissible unless they're necessary to establish probable cause for an arrest?
And I apologize, I'm not familiar with the Wisconsin rule, but yes, something like that. And because in this particular case, the field show-up was done at 3 o'clock. The police had probable cause at 2:30 to arrest the defendant. They could have taken him in and done a more neutral photo lineup. They could have made things more neutral. Nevertheless, they took this unduly suggestive manner and they presented it for the purpose of getting the guests to be more definitive, a more definitive idea.
Mr. Park, you're into your rebuttal time. Did you want to
I'd like to save
that time, or do you have other points you'd like to make now?
There were a lot of points, but I run out of time, Judge. Thank you.
We'll have you back in rebuttal after we hear from Ms. Thomas and Mr. Park.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Chief Justices, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Lauren Thomas on behalf of the state. Hope everybody can hear me well enough.
We can.
Based on the questions, there's a lot to discuss today, but I figured that coming in on a field show up, there were going to be a lot of things to discuss, especially in light of Kabagbag and Kabinitan and cases that are currently ongoing in on the mainland. And with regard to the five-factor test, I'm aware that there are two, I think, important cases pending cert review in Utah. And Utah, as you, based on the questions I've heard this morning, I'm sure the court's aware that Utah has, a while back, maybe in the early 2000s or even earlier, expanded the Biggers test beyond the five. In fact, they kept the first two, opportunity to view and attention to detail, but they expanded those three, and I'm not going to get into the detail unless the court wants me to through questioning, I will.
Well, while you're on that, Ms. Yes. Thomas, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you give us your view about whether we should expand the consideration of the factors? As Justice Pollack mentioned, there were some factors that arguably maybe didn't fall within the five factors, such as being handcuffed and such as being the conversation that took place with the witness ahead of time. So what's your view about whether those facts should have been considered beyond just the five, the facts that would be relevant to the five factors?
Okay, I hear possibly two answers in this, Justice Wilson. First of all, Judge Kawamura, very experienced attorney in the criminal arena, experienced judge. She applied the test that is currently the precedent of this court. And many courts, I still think the majority follow Biggers and Mason, but that's been changing. And I came here today expecting changes in light of Kabagbag, this court's notation of the New Jersey studies, the decisions out of New Jersey. Other courts like New York have said per se it's excluded. Now we're going to discuss the reliability and possibility of your in-court ID. So there are a lot of issues here. And I don't want to see the goalposts moved for this particular case, but because those were the rules in place for Judge Kawamura and the parties when they were litigating these issues. However, I think, and I'll be honest with the court, I believe it's probably going to be expanded, and this will be the case. That's my goal. I don't have a crystal ball, but I think based on what this court has.
If we're going to expand it, what would your druthers be? What do you think we should be taking into, or a trial court should be taking into consideration in determining whether the identification was reliable?
Well, Justice Nakayama, I looked at the Utah factors, and that might be my other folder on my desk, but I know they keep the first two. And they sort of tweak the other three because they don't feel that Biggers and Mason put the emphasis or actually put an emphasis on things they believe scientific studies, as this court noted in Kabagbag, like level of certainty, are important to that reliability determination. So I can see this jurisdiction going this way if the court, I mean, I accept that as a prosecutor. I think, in my opinion, over my almost 29 years now, I think the police do a pretty good job, actually.
Well, let's talk about the police, because one of the things that the police officer said in this case was that the procedures, the new HPD procedures, were not in place. And
Justice Pollack, if you could speak into your mic.
I'm sorry. Are you familiar with the procedures? I guess it's policy number 4.30 that they adopted apparently formally adopted in February 2015, although
I
found another one, procedures from October 2014, but I'm not so sure that was officially adopted, although it was on the web.
Yeah, I do have a copy. I have the same one, probably Justice Pollack, February 2nd, 2015, policy number 4.3.
If you compare those procedures to this case, it's almost as if they were... Everything they did was contrary to what they're required to do.
In that respect, Justice Pollack, the officer testified honestly. He was a two-year veteran at that point, that he did not recall, because these weren't in place in January. I don't have a copy of the October one, but I'm going based on what's in the record in his testimony, that he wasn't aware of possibly having to do this preamble. you know, giving the pre-warning instructions to the witness. But to his credit, his language to her before that field show up was very neutral. He didn't call him a suspect.
Well, that's what he testified. That's not what she testified. She said she was told they had captured the guy in the laundromat, and she believed it was meant to be the person that she had seen earlier. And you know, even the procedures of being arrested, the person having handcuffs and standing next to police officers, those have been criticized long before. These rules were in the process.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree with you. I do.
And in terms of the, you know, you say that the judge applied the correct standard, the five-factor test. However, in Kabagbag, we listed factors to consider in terms of reliability of eyewitness identification, and we discussed them in the context of a jury.
Correct.
However, why would the same factors not have applied to a judge determining reliability in a motion to suppress? We said that these are factors to consider for reliability.
I understand what you're saying, Justice McKenna, but I also can see possibly where the parties in that trial and the judge were, what they were thinking at the time. The jury instructions cover all that.
Wait,
but
of the jury instructions, do the jury instructions tell them that if they believe that these suggestive procedures taint the reliability? I mean, is there anything specific? I understand that there's an eyewitness, and then there's a show-up, and it talks about considering it, but I didn't see anything where the jury is told something to the effect, hey, if you find these procedures so suggestive, therefore you can consider this not reliable. There's nothing like that in the instructions.
I mean, I have a copy of the instructions as well. I mean, I think the judge was making her best determination based on the case law that's out there and that they're instructed to follow. It doesn't always go perfect. We know that. We've had enough Tachibana's problems to know that. But I think that the judge followed the case law, the precedent in place. If the court's going to expand on that to cover things more in depth along the lines of cross-racial or, you know, how they even more specifically are going to weigh that, I'm not sure about. I've read the case on it, but off the top of my head right now today, I can't say what more in detail they needed other than this, but I'm sure if that's what the court's intending to do, well, we'll see it. But I don't want to forget this point. If the court, I mean, I'm hoping my position here is today that the ID was reliable. There were things that were not good about it. I understand that. In every case, we get good facts and bad facts. The fact that he was handcuffed, I understand that factor. But in this case, to come upon defendant naked, I mean, it's just not, that's abnormal
behavior. That goes
behavior.
To harmless. That goes yeah. to harmless. Well, let's talk yeah. about the identification.
Okay.
You know, she, 911, skinny black guy. She sees the guy in the show up. He's turned into a Caucasian. A stocky Caucasian. How do we go from skinny black guy to stocky Caucasian?
Justice McKenna, I think for this description, now, her English is a second language for her. Although if you listen to the 911 tape, she's very coherent and organized.
Her English is actually not bad.
It's
actually
not
bad.
Good. But I can understand in the setting of a court, people are nervous and they want to use an interpreter. We see this often.
Right.
They want to use interpreter because they're most comfortable in their native language. So, and that's understandable. But I think that her attention, when you listen to that 911 call, I would have hoped that the dispatcher would have stopped instead of talked over her at times. Because I would suggest that what is being utilized as an inaccurate description or a mistake is actually just a little confusion between the two people talking, because the dispatcher is not letting the witness say. Because at one point she says, can I describe or tell you what I saw? And then the dispatcher, understand his sense of urgency, peppering her with questions. But sometimes they're talking over each other.
Does that argument really help you? I think that argument, I mean, what 911 is part of HPD, I think.
It is.
Okay, let me ask you something else, because let's assume we come up with these suggestiveness situation, and the test that seems to being applied by our courts, and it's not 100% clear that that's what the trial court applied, but generally, if something is suggestive, and I think Justice McKenna was sort of alluding to this earlier, then the identification is excluded unless it's shown to there to be a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. That's the test, right?
Correct.
So my first question to you, let's suppose it's not a very substantial likelihood of misidentification. Suppose it's a substantial likelihood of misidentification. Is that enough? I mean, it still comes in under our test. I guess my question in a bigger perspective is, we find something that's been done very suggestively, and yet we're requiring, before the identification to come in, the burden has to be shown there's a high likelihood that there's going to be a misidentification. It seems like we're imposing a test that should be the opposite of what it is.
Well, perhaps I'm not understanding your question correctly, Justice Pollack, because there was a stipulation below, right?
Right.
By the state, impermissibly suggestive. Although I would have liked that people start with, we agree.
I'm not sure it's that impermissibly. I think it was suggestive, right?
Well, I think they used the term impermissibly suggestive, which I would, and perhaps I'm not reading all the case law correctly, but I see the terms across the jurisdictions used interchangeably. And maybe some clarification on that would assist going forward in the future. Is it, as other courts talk about unnecessarily, I think we have precedent here that talks about unnecessarily suggestive, suggesting that if there's an exigency or a necessity, then it's okay. Then we have impermissibly suggestive, inherently unfair. So,
but why should we start out if the government has, because a lot of this is from police procedures in this case, you know, person being arrested, the things that weren't said. So if we start out with that kind of perspective or circumstances where it's impermissibly suggestive, why should the burden be so high in order to keep the identification out?
Justice Pollack, would this cover both the out-of-court ID and the in-court ID? Because we've got two different IDs. Right, we have the out-of-court ID, of course, made on Dayton at Kellis Street, but we have the in-court ID made at, for the first time, at the motion to suppress, and then again in trial. So, I know different jurisdictions have a different take on that.
You're correct.
And whether you've got to show an independent source, so in other words, show that her identification of him, despite that suggestiveness, impermissibly or unnecessarily, though I'm not agreeing this. That I like to use the term unnecessarily. I think some things necessitated doing this show up right then and there. As much as, you know, opposing counsel and members may feel that's not correct.
I am addressing the out of court, but that is a good point. The courts have addressed it in different ways.
They have, and I don't believe any of our cases really speak to that, because once we determine that, despite the suggestiveness of the procedures used, that ID is reliable and not likely to be a corruptive effect to her.
Ms. Thomas, let me ask you this. She identifies on her own accord in the 911, describes a fellow as a skinny black guy.
Yes.
Assuming she's using black as a racial term, they catch the fellow, and he's not a skinny black guy. He's a medium-sized local fellow. And I think this is the gist of it. If they had brought in a lineup, do you have every confidence she would have picked him out?
I do.
Mean,
I do.
It's probably the same fellow. But
I do.
The question is, did she get a good enough look at him? He's crawling in the window. She's seeing kind of the bottom half of him as he's crawling into
That's
a window.
That's her, really, the tail end of her view on the sea of him, no pun intended.
Oh, and but, also, she doesn't have her glasses on.
Yes. So there's a lot of points to be made there, Justice Nakayama. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So how does that play into it?
Here's what she says,
she can't see beyond 10 to 15 feet without her glasses, and she doesn't have her glasses.
I'd have to beg to differ on she can't see 10 to 15 feet. She says she uses her glasses maybe for distance driving, although she says she still can see the road signs. So the fact that she didn't have her glasses on when she first saw him, so she's walking down the, if you look at the photos and evidence, she's walking down that corridor between the apartments, and she sees her suspicious circumstances. Again, goes to her attention to detail. Here's somebody crouched down in front of a window, and when she gets closer, granted, all she can see is his profile.
Didn't she make it pretty clear she only saw his profile from about 3 to 5 seconds? And wasn't she with her young son?
Well, she also said he's 12, and she wasn't afraid he was going to run away.
She wasn't afraid?
She wasn't concerned. She felt confident of her son that her attention could be drawn towards this.
All right, but I'm just saying, she's still with her son.
Correct.
Here's a woman walking with her son. She sees what appears to be a burglar. Do you think when she went to the Shoah, she didn't even want him to see her. She asked not to be seen by him. She wanted to make sure he didn't see her. Don't you think a person, a mother walking a child and seeing someone, she's not going to be like staring, you know, she's not going to want this person coming after him.
Exactly. And I think that's why she looked at his profile, tried not to draw.
3 to 5 seconds.
Yeah. I know how that sounds, but I would challenge anyone to don't look at somebody you know, but if you're walking on the street, I did this test myself, just look at someone. 3 seconds is actually not an unreasonable amount of time to be able to later make an identification of someone. People look different.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I understand that you feel strongly about the fact that this identification was sufficiently reliable, but let's assume that the determination is, as we discussed with Mr. Park, that in fact it's not reliable. It is a suggestive misidentification that must be excluded. And I wanted to ask you about, you talked about the burden of government, where you are in the situation, you have to contend with the finding of it being impermissibly suggestive. But a standard, of course, it's as high as the government perhaps is asked to meet in any cases to show if there's error, whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, and you know, I think Henderson's been cited a number of times about, and it's the point there being that misidentification is the leading cause of, if you will, findings of guilt that are in error in the United States. And with that said, in this case, is it your position that in the event that there was error, the evidence should have been excluded, that nonetheless it's still harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I looked at the harmless error argument, and I recognize that it was not made in the briefs. And I don't even think the ICA addressed harmless. So I'm in a position of possibly being judicially stopped from arguing harmless. But aside from that, honestly, for a court, substantively, how do you get to the point where, in this case, if none of the ID should come in, how is it harmless?
Yes, and I'd be interested in all the research you've done. Have you ever seen a case where the determination is made that there was a misidentification, there was a violation of the defendant's due process rights, and the court then found that nonetheless it was harmless error?
Wait a second, we're not talking about misidentification here, are we? We're just talking about an impermissibly suggestive show up, but not a misidentification.
Any authority that you can see where it's been found that the identification was impermissibly suggestive, it was unreliable, the evidence was excluded, and then the court found that it was harmless error?
Not unless there was other evidence of other witnesses IDing the defendant. But we only have one witness here.
I can understand that speculation, yeah. But have you seen a single case where a court did actually conclude that where you have this, you have a misidentification that is considered to be a violation of due process, that it was harmless?
Again, where it's just one witness?
Because I'm talking about any case in which the court has found. Yeah, I mean, yeah. We see that the cases generally being remanded, but is there a case that you can see where that level of violation, as Mr. Park said, this is, in his view at least, the primary evidence against the defendant was the identification. So if the identification goes out, I mean, I'm sorry to belabor the point because you've, in a sense, acknowledged the significance of it, but I just wondered if you have any examples of where it was found harmless.
I'm the closest case I can think of. I don't have the site right at my fingertip, but it's an Alaska case, State versus Young. Several eyewitnesses to a shooting. And I think they may have said that when it came into what actually happened to be a criminal defense attorney who witnessed and made ID. His ID was bad, but there are other witnesses that they were able to tie up the case with. So
you're
it was
not suggesting that you need an identification to have a conviction for a burglary, right? You have to have a
based on these facts,
witness identification.
No, absolutely not. But how else do we place this defendant in the building?
Didn't Officer Hose testify at trial, and didn't he identify the defendant as the person who was nude in the laundry room?
With the watch and the burglar's tools?
He said, he asked Ms. Laraway, would you be able to identify?
I'm talking about the trial.
Oh, during the trial.
We're talking about trial.
Right.
The argument, the discussion is harmlessness right now.
Okay.
So, Ms. Thomas, you're not arguing that it's harmless. Is that correct at this point?
Well, perhaps I'm misunderstanding the question, because if we're going to go to harmlessness, then I think we're getting along the lines of that cooperation theory. And I'm not sure courts have wholeheartedly endorse that, whether you look at corroborating evidence.
Well, I guess we talked about the 911 tape
that
came in, plus all the other evidence, including the officer's testimony about what he found when he responded to the scene. And that, given that evidence, can you say that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Or do you believe in good faith you can make that argument?
Let me represent to you that Officer Kamanao testified at trial that the defendant was the person that he saw in the laundry room naked with the watch, the stolen watch, on his wrist.
No, I understand that.
But there was not.
I'm so sorry if I could just ask you to answer the question I had.
And the question is whether I'd always...
Given those circumstances, can you argue in good faith that this was error was harmless?
I want to make sure I understand that. That becomes a very critical answer, Chief Justice. I make sure I understand that, because I think the court has to determine then and overrule Judge Kawamura that none of the ID was reliable. Or are we just talking about the pretrial ID?
I think just the Chief Justice question wants you to assume, for the sake of argument, that the identification show up would be excluded at trial, as would be her identification of him at trial. That's the. Am I stating that correctly?
Yeah, assume only the 911 tape came in, plus all the other evidence, but none of her testimony, or no testimony about her ID in the field, and no ID by her in the courtroom.
I don't know how it's harmless, but.
How many burglaries do they have eyewitness testimony for?
Very few.
And do they get convictions on burglaries without eyewitness testimony?
Yes.
And here you have the defendant with the goods in the building.
I guess maybe where the misunderstanding is, Justice Nakayama, is The police needed her identification of defendant on the scene in order to move that burglary case forward.
I thought there was testimony that they already had probable cause. Yeah. They thought they had probable cause for an arrest.
I know, but what...
Before the show-up ID.
That's what the officer believed, but that's not the legal standard for whether or not there's probable cause. Ultimately,
there wasn't probable cause here for an arrest?
For burglary, we're not talking about detaining stolen property or being in possession of mislaid property. And that requires an intentional knowing state of mind. We're talking about whether we have evidence of him breaking and entering into this apartment. And then afterwards, if you're caught with the goods.
Burglary includes unlawfully remaining.
Correct.
Well.
Correct. I'd like to think we can get a conviction on that, but I think it'd be very difficult.
Well, the evidence was your evidence based on the fact that he was caught in the laundry room? And therefore, he was remaining on the premises?
That's open to the public.
You're suggesting that if this case had been conferred to your office by Honolulu Police Department for prosecution based just on the 911 tape and the defendant being in the laundry room naked with at least clothing that matched the description of the 911 tape, with burglar's tools, with things that were taken from the apartment on his body, that would not have been enough for you to prosecute this case?
It's very circumstantial.
Aren't most cases circumstantial?
But
is that the standard that we apply to harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Whether there was probable cause, whether there was substantial evidence, isn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt one in which there has to be a determination by the court whether there's any reasonable possibility that the excluded evidence would have contributed to the conviction? And isn't that a high standard because we're talking about the constitutional right to be free of impermissive identification?
I agree.
Okay, Ms. Thomas, if I could ask you, your support or you believe there was no clear error by the circuit court here, correct, in applying the test?
Correct.
The test, as she articulated it in her order, appears to be the five-factor test that we articulated in the Padilla case that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, articulated in Biggers. But in the in Kabagbag, we talked about 12 factors potentially that a jury should hear about. How can we have confidence that Judge Kawamura didn't just focus in on those five factors, which research now suggests might be too narrow? Do we know whether she at least gave consideration to a broader range of factors, or is that a mystery to us?
Well, I don't think we know that she, in fact, did not consider her decisions, her findings and conclusions in light of Kabagbag. I mean, they gave the jury instruction, so that alerts me and tells me that they're aware of all those factors. Whether a court's going to craft even more factors onto the jury instructions without the approval of this court, I think they'd probably be a little reluctant.
But in terms of her oral ruling on the motion to suppress, she just went through the five factors. And when you look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, she only addressed the five factors. She did not address the reliability factors under Kabagbag, correct? The additional reliability factors.
Well, she didn't cite Kabagbag, the order.
She didn't go through the additional factors that are included in Kabagbag.
And I'm not sure if any sitting circuit court judge would go through those factors, and I don't think the parties briefed that as well in the lower court. So what I'm saying is the judge applied the law in effect at that time.
But didn't Padilla suggest if those five factors as part of a broader analysis of the totality of the circumstances?
I think many cases suggest that list is not
exclusive,
correct. But in light of the record, I mean, the suppression hearing occurred and then it was furthered to another date. So Judge Kawamura also had additional time to reflect before she made her oral ruling. What was it, 10 days later, 8 days later?
In your view, did she address every argument that was raised to her by the parties?
In the order?
Were the parties arguing beyond those five factors? Were they suggesting some of the Kabagbag factors, perhaps not explicitly, but Did she address everything that was actually put in play by the parties, to your knowledge?
In, my time's almost up.
You can finish your answer.
Because I just want to make two points, if I can indulge a court. I believe the parties did cover a number of things orally, through their questioning of the witnesses, and also through their briefing, although the parties tend to stick with biggers and the factors of this court. But I just have two things I want to say to the court.
Very briefly.
Yes. Any changes in the rule, I would hope that is applied prospective. I appreciate the court's decision in Ault. Excellent decision, because it gave the parties below and the judges, what does retroactive mean, what does limited pipeline mean, and what does prospective mean? I can tell you, as a litigant advising trial attorneys and all the time, that was critical to us going forward from that. So I would implore the court that if it's unlikely to expand its factors, then make that clear to the lower courts. I just want to read one thing. I know these aren't the facts of this case, but it's a concurring opinion by Justice Blackmun back in Moore versus Illinois. And again, I am aware these aren't the facts of this case, but what the court does and going forward is going to affect every type of case that the police investigate and that we prosecute. And this is Justice Blackmun's concurrence. Very quickly, one last word. I disassociate myself from the implication twice appearing in the court's opinion, and that there is something insignificant or unreliable about a rape victim's observation during the crime of facial features of her assailant when that observation lasts 10 to 15 seconds. Time, of course, is always a comparative matter. 15 seconds perhaps would mean little in the identification of scores of separate individuals participating in an illegal riot. But 10 to 15 seconds of observation of the face of a rapist at midday by his female victim during the commission of a crime by no means is insufficient to leave an accurate and an indelible impression.
Yeah. This is not a rape.
No, I understand that,
but this is quite different.
But my concern is, Your Honor, is that if we prosecute all different types of cases, and I think even just a few seconds, I think witnesses, victims are able to discern and provide a reliable ID to the court. Thank you
very much for your argument, Ms. Thomas. We'll hear from Mr. Park now in rebuttal.
Okay. I really appreciate the prosecutor's candor in her arguments. And I'm a trial lawyer, and I do appeals. When I look at the facts of this case, they're so inconsistent with what is necessary to prove identification beyond a reasonable doubt, that it may rise to the level of possible misidentification, as Justice Nakayama feels this is not a misidentification case. But to quickly address some of the issues, I believe Judge Kawamura did not consider all the Kabegbeg factors. She did consider some of the five factors that are the existing law, and she disregarded other factors that I believe went to the reliability, the second part of a witness being reliable, to trust whether that witness is credible. She, in her decision, decided to leave it up to the trier of fact. So she didn't see it as a real question of law that she needed to address. She saw it as, well, we're going to leave it up, the reliance aspect, to the trier of fact. So there is a problem with the existing law and the Kabagbag factors. I agree that maybe it should be expanded to pretrial identification to avoid trial judges from having to be able to excuse police conduct, because the Kabagbag factors, I believe, help with respect to determining the reliability and credibility of a witness, and they should be looking at police conduct. And on that note, I believe that this court possibly should expand the existing law to consider the HPD practice. Right now, the practice or the law focuses only on the witness, their opportunity, their ability, etc. But we do need to look at the police conduct.
And does a violation of a police procedural, I have the police procedures, the fact that they may violate it, does that mean the identification's not reliable?
Yes.
It does?
It helps. It leads one to look at exactly what the police did to influence the individual's identification.
It's a consideration.
It's a consideration, right. A substantial consideration in this particular fact-based case.
Mr. Park, what about Ms. Thomas's argument the court should do this prospectively, that Judge Kawamura did everything right under our current law, and that if we are going to change, it should only be going forward into the future? What's your response to that?
I think Judge Kawamura made an error because she punted. She should have looked at the reliability of that witness. But she punted, it was the trial.
When you say she punted, that means that counsel argued to her that the factor should be expanded. I don't recall seeing such an argument made, so I'm not so sure I would agree with the characterization that she punted.
Well, she, in her decision, said that the reliance or the credibility of the witness is one for the trier of fact. And she didn't see herself as trier of fact at the time of the suppression. That's what I mean. And Your Honor, I'm going to stop now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement and will issue a decision at a future time. And at this point, on behalf of the court, I want to thank the students and teachers who are joined, who are here with us today from Hawaii Preparatory Academy, West Hawaii Explorations Academy, Konawana High School, West Hawaii Homeschool Group, Ke Kula'o, Ehunui Kai Malino, and of course, Ke Ala Kehe High School. Our Courts in the Community program is designed to give these high school students a unique hands-on experience in how our judicial system works, and the future of our system of government depends on the public's understanding of the Constitution and the protections that it provides. And based on what we've seen here today and what we see here in this room in front of us and the hard work that was put in by the students and teachers to prepare for the argument today, we can see that our future is in good hands. So please join me in acknowledging all of our students and teachers here today. Also, we have a number of special guests who've come to join us, including Chief Judge Greg Nakamura from here in the Third Circuit, Judge Melvin Fujino, Judge Margaret Masanaga, retired Chief Judge Ronnie Barra, retired Judge Elizabeth Strance. From the County Council, we have Council Members Miley David, Drew Kanuha, Karen Eoff, and we have from Eileen O'Hara's office, Barbara Lively, here on behalf of Council Member O'Hara. We have from the Hawaii State Bar Foundation, Curtis Sakai, the president of our Hawaii State Bar Association, Howard Luke, from the Public Defender's Office, Wendy DeWeese, from the Prosecuting Attorney's Office, Mark Disher, on Corporation Counsel, we have Renee Schoen and Larissa Harold. So again, we thank you all for being here today. Please join me in acknowledging our guests. Also, we really deeply appreciate Ke Ala Kehe High School for hosting us today. We're back here for the second time. We were so excited to have the opportunity to return. We had such a good experience last time. We're so grateful for the aloha you extended to us. Principal Wilfred Murakami, Tammy Furr, Alan Voigt, David Hewitt, Jim Young, Ezra Whitman, who I think has more than 90 students here today. We know from the We the People competition, who always fields great teams in that competition, statewide competition, security staff here, everybody has been
just so warm and welcoming to us. There are a lot of other folks who actually put this program together today, including students at the William S. Richardson School of Law, and who together with their Judiciary History Center helped us to put together the program that was used to teach the students. So again, please a big warm round of applause for Kealakehe High School. And you know, what makes this so special is that we have attorneys who go to the classrooms, who talk to the students about the case and give them the opportunity when they're able to engage in a mock oral argument. So when we come on campus, the students know about the case and understand what the arguments are, and this program wouldn't be what it is without them. So here on the Big Island in West Hawaii Bar, we had 26 attorneys volunteer. That's a huge percentage of the members of the bar here. So I really want to thank each and every one of them in the West Hawaii Bar Association. Donna Paiesco is president. Aloha. One thing very special about what happened here today is that our argument was broadcast on Naleo television, both live here on the Big Island and then live streamed as well. That's the first time that we've had a live broadcast of our program, so we thank the production crew and the folks at Naleo for bringing us to the whole island today. And then there are a few people I really need to single out for being instrumental in making this happen. I mentioned Donna Paiesco before from the West Hawaii Bar Association. Carol Kitaoka, also a member of the bar, who coordinated all the volunteer attorneys, organized this event. Donna's was the MC this morning, so she did a great job of that. I want to thank Judge Robert Kim, who is a longtime member of the West Hawaii Bar, now a circuit court judge here on the west side of the island. He's going to be serving as our moderator today, so thanks to Judge Kim. And we had a number of employees and staff members from the Third Circuit who are here today helping out: Lester Oshiro, Don West, Lonnie Ng, Ayanna Wainwright. And in addition to all those people who helped, we've had some folks who really have provided fundraising or donations that make this event possible. So the Hawaii State Bar Association, our statewide organization of lawyers, its foundation has been instrumental in making this happen, funding the lunches, the buses, and then airfare for the law students who came over to help prepare for this. So many, many thanks to HSBA and again Howard Luke, and mahalo to the West Hawaii Bar Association for helping fund the lunches for all of our volunteer attorneys today, and beverages and drinks. And also we had some donations from Paradise Beverage and Long's Drugs of beverages for today. So thanks to all of those people. Can you please join me in acknowledging them? So at this point, we'll adjourn, and then we'll be back, first the attorneys and then the court, for the question and answer session portion of our session today. And there being no further business, this court stands adjourned. Mahalo.